and you're very welcome to the very first edition of International Politics with me, Peter Carney. I'm with you every fortnight. And on this fortnight show, we've got a lot lined up for you. We're going to be speaking to Mary Russell about her travels in Syria. We're going to be speaking to Rabbi Weiss from the organisation Naturae Carta, a group of Orthodox Jews who are opposed to the current state of Israel. And we'll also be speaking to Tim Pat Coogan about his book on the famine and England's responsibility in creating the famine. All that coming up on this fortnight show. And I caught up with Mary Russell, and this is what Mary Russell had to say about her travels in Syria and some opinions on the current situation in Syria also. So, Mary Russell, writer and traveller, it's probably the briefest way I can describe you after all you've done, having written for the Irish Times and The Guardian and produced work for radio and travelled extensively. And I suppose it's the travel that we can look at first. You've done a lot of travelling, and it seems in particular the Middle East seems to catch you. Would that be fair to say?
Well, it has of late, over the last 10 years. But and that was really accidental. But I've travelled a lot around different parts of Africa and also Russia. Okay. And during the Soviet period as well. But the Middle East thing has actually a longish story to it, in that I was in Sudan a long time ago writing about refugee camps. And then, of course, in Sudan, a lot of people speak Arabic. And I thought, I've really got to get a handle on this Arabic language.
Yeah.
And I've always been interested in refugees and the plight of refugees.
Right.
So two things came together, with the refugees and the Arabic language, that took me to the West Bank, to the Palestinians, and I spent some time working there in a place called Hebron, El Khalil, it's called. So that was I quite like the Arabic language, even though I don't speak it very well. And that kind of lay dormant for a while I did other things. And then one of the ways I was trying to learn Arabic I was living in Oxford at the time, and I went to the local College of Further Education, and the teacher was actually from Damascus. Now, I was vague. I didn't know really where Damascus was at that time. But we kept in touch, and he was a very, very good teacher. Hmm. And he taught us about the culture as well. And so fast forward, 4 or 5 years, I suddenly find myself in Damascus, having got the idea really from him.
Right, very good. Yeah, so the Middle East or the Arabic world kind of took you really from that visit
to
Sudan.
That's right, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you've travelled quite a bit as you mentioned already, Damascus. You know quite a bit about Syria. Through the media and various different forms, we find out a lot about Syria. What's your experience of having been there compared to what we see in the media?
It just makes me terribly sad and distressed, which is nothing compared to what the people are experiencing there themselves. But I have very, very good memories of Syria.
Right.
Because I spent on and off something like 10 years toing and froing, and then having longer periods of sort of 3 months and so on. So cycling around and using local buses and so on. And everywhere I went, I experienced hospitality of the highest order. Mm. I mean, we think in Ireland, we're great at the foilshire thing, but they surpass everybody. So I enjoyed all that, and I also enjoyed Damascus. I stayed in a little no-star hotel, really. It was like a hostel, but it was run by a family, and that was great. Mm. And so I came away with very, very good memories, and I'm determined to retain those memories, because it was the people that gave them to me, and the people are still there. I hope many of them are still there. And that's really what I'm focusing on, because what is happening there is so awful at the moment that it seems in a way strange. If I give a reading from my book about Syria, there were quite funny things happened to me, and it seems strange to be laughing. But that's how it was then, and I'm sure that the people there retain all that still.
And did you ever get any sense that there was... that people were unhappy with the regime when you travelled through it?
I got people were very careful. I mean, what I realised in retrospect was that it was a very safe country, by the way. I always made that, especially to a woman travelling on her own, is one of the first things people ask about. And yes, it was quite safe. I just say there that actually statistically men are more likely to be attacked
really
travelling than women are. Uh-huh. They just find themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time and so on. I think maybe women take a bit more care, I don't know. But anyway, so where was I? Sorry.
Did you witness anything, or did you see anything to show people were unhappy?
Yes, people were critical of the situation, But they were very careful to explain to me that they were loyal to Syria. They would all tell them, I'm Syrian, I love Syria, but there's some things that we would like to see changed. And at that time, the Assad had just come in, he hadn't been elected, of course, he was appointed. And the hopes were that things would change. So there was a good feeling at that time. And then, of course, everything went downhill. I was followed, of course, once or twice in a very inept way by the Mukhabarat. We all know what the Mukhabarat now are, the secret police, but they weren't very secret. They were just fellas on putt-putts coming up to have a look at you. It was a strange woman. Why is she going out to look at our dam? You see, dams are always they're always vulnerable places, you know, because you could destroy you could pollute the water, you know, so it's for security reasons.
So they're keeping an eye on you to make sure you weren't polluting the water.
So, one day a fella did come on his putt-putt and he circled around very obviously to me, and I just nodded to him and he nodded back again, and that was it. So he was just having a look, and on another occasion when I was having coffee with a friend, she said to me, don't say anything, be careful of what you say, and the fella had come in and sat down. But everybody knew, everybody was aware of that sort of thing, you know, and I'm as innocent as the day is long, you know. There was nothing that I was doing or needed to hide. So none of that bothered me.
So people were just careful about what they said. It was kind of,
well, they were, I'll tell you what, they were careful. They were critical of the outside world because they felt they had had a bad deal, the Arabs, and they have had a bad deal, there's no doubt about it, from Europe and the West and so on over the years, not just in the last few years. But that was the one thing that kept, the message that kept coming through to me, that we love Syria, we're not criticising Syria, this is our country. Nobody wanted to leave it, even though there were ways of earning better money and so on. So they might go to other Arab countries, but the idea always was to come back home, a bit like Ireland. Boss you there. So I got that kind of feel. I mean, a lot of the criticism is coming from people outside Syria, of course, you know, people who did have to leave or who left and then thought, well, things, were they that rosy and so on. So you have to sift through everything because it's a very complex situation. Their history is so complex. It's hard to get your head around it.
The defining of borders and all that type of
thing.
And did you ever witness anything untoward in your travels, say, in Syria? Anything that would have represented, say, a human rights abuse or anything of
Not
that nature?
Thing, but that doesn't mean anything, because I didn't see it doesn't mean. I know there is infamous prison in a place called Tadmor, where in the 80s, one of the towns, Hama, there was an uprising against the president, and there's the father of the present president, and it was a Muslim brotherhood, and a lot of them, were something like 10,000, were just taken away and disappeared. They were put into prison and whatever. So I knew that I was in the town of Tadmor, so that's where the prison was, and people did tell me of the terrible things that had happened and so on. But as far as they were concerned, that was back in the 80s, and nobody had any idea that the whole thing was going to blow up again.
When was the last time you visited Syria?
I was there just about 18 months before Daraa, before the whole thing exploded. And I haven't been back since. I will go, definitely. See, I have friends who live on, or sorry, friends who are on both sides of the political divide. They are Alawit, who support the president, and they were Sunni, who are the majority, but who are oppressed, not allowed to do things. I keep in touch with both of them. To a certain extent, life goes on as normal in Damascus. It's hard to believe, but it does, the people to and fro, and the children go to university, and people go shopping and so on, because we see the worst of it the whole time on television.
And you kind of touched on it there earlier on. Would you say the, quote-unquote problems in the Arab world are of their own doing, or have been accelerated by quote-unquote Western influence or interference?
What's the question, sorry?
The problems, what we see as problems, and they may not very well be problems, but what we see as problems from here in the West, is it by and large, would you say, the created by the Arabs themselves, or is it as a result of Western interference?
Oh,
mainly?
I see. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's certainly Western interference in the sense that NATO went into Libya. I think that's having a major effect,
yeah.
Especially I think the Russians are saying to themselves, that's never, ever going to happen again.
Yes.
You know, so that's why they're digging in Syria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're given a talk about your experience in the in Syria, and you're giving in the Chester
yeah.
Beatty.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's coming up on the, I think it's on the Saturday, the 2nd of February.
That's right, yeah.
And on the talk, you're going to be talking quite a lot about your book about Syria, which is My Home is Your Country, A Journey Through Syria.
You've almost got it right. It's My Home is Your Home.
My Home is Your Home, excuse me. My
a
Home
journey
is
right
Your Home.
You. Yeah. Because that's what it's a saying, it's an Arab saying. When you walk into somebody's house, they say, like we say, make yourself at home. They say, my home is your home. And that's really what I experienced
okay.
The whole time. Yeah.
Very good. And what can people expect to hear at the talk?
I took my bicycle with me.
Yeah.
So I cycled, not everywhere, but I cycled around quite a lot. And so that kind of made me very vulnerable, which is lovely, to people saying, oh, madame, come stay, come visit, come and eat, come and sleep, and so on, when you're with just a person on a bike.
Mm.
So I was three strange things. I was a woman. I was a woman on her own, and I was a woman on her own on a bike.
Right, yeah.
You know, and that just kind of caught, they could not believe it. But
yeah.
It was great, you
yeah.
know. It wasn't something that they turned away from.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be talking about the great city. I've went in masses of places. One, the city of Aleppo,
mm-hmm.
Which is mentioned, Shakespeare mentions it, and it was a major on the trade route, the Silk Route, from China and so on, through Syria, across the Mediterranean, and over to Italy, and then to the great houses of all around Europe. So it was a very, very important cosmopolitan city. And there I met, actually, I went looking for him. The church in Syria, because they have Orthodox churches as well, is mainly a Muslim country, but there is also Christian Orthodox. And I met a man that I had read about who was, at one point when I read about him originally, he was going to imitate the saint or the holy fellow who back in about 400 built himself a pillar and went and lived on top of the pillar. They were called Stylites.
Uh-huh.
And they just... mad things. They stayed up on top of this pillar for the whole of their lives.
Yeah.
And this guy was going to do the same thing. And I thought, well, I don't know, in the 21st century, maybe 20th century at that time, maybe it'd be interesting to meet him. And I found that he had gone to Maynooth.
Right.
He'd gone to study, and then the trail went cold. And then when I was in Damascus, in Aleppo, I went to one of the churches and I asked if anybody knew about him. They said, oh yeah, he's here this evening. I couldn't believe it.
Mm.
He's called Ephraim, and I met him, and he's very large, cheery, large bishop now. And I thought, there's no way that he's going to be spending his life up on top of a pillar. So there were all sorts of sort of things that I just stumbled on by accident,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
which
fantastic.
Was, oh, those were the things really which were great altogether.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. Well, people are going to find out a lot more on the 2nd of February in the Chester Beatty Library, and find out a lot more about your book, My Home is Your Home, A Journey Through Syria. Mary Russell, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And now we have Rabbi Weiss from the organisation Naturae Carta, who are Orthodox Jews opposed to the current state of Israel. Rabbi Weiss, you're the spokesperson of Naturae Carta, and you're, how will I put it, a group of Orthodox Jews who are opposed to the establishment of what you say is the so-called state of Israel. Is that correct?
Well, yes.
Can you tell us maybe why, because this might come as a surprise to a lot of listeners here in Ireland. Why is it that you oppose the state of Israel?
Well, basically, it's not the Naturae Carta that opposes. It is the Judaism is in and of itself is totally contradictory to the concept of the Zionism, the ideology which is the root and the ideology of the State of Israel, why it is created, the State of Israel. Israel is built on this ideology of Zionism, and Zionism is the antithetical to what Judaism is. Judaism is religion. It's a religion subservient to God, to accept God's rule on the world. And Zionism is trying to transform this concept into a base material concept of nationalism, having the piece of land ruling over a land and saying that we're a proud nation amongst nations, that we have a strong army, a strong Olympic team, and so forth. This is not what Judaism is in its essence.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There's a much more than that, if you would allow me.
Okay, if it runs so contrary to this so-called State of Israel, then why have so many Jews gone down that road? Why did the state exist to begin with?
Yes, with the help of the Almighty, Judaism, but again, we have to just bear with me a minute or two. Judaism is a religion of thousands of years that Jews made a covenant with God to uphold his commandments. Zionism is a mere 100-odd years, the whole concept of Zionism and the state, to create the state. The manner in which this the movers and shakers of this movement in order to gain legitimacy amongst the Jewish communities, they use different ploys. First of all, we have to understand, in order to create a state, you must have a tremendous backing as far as money goes, and it's a colossal undertaking. And so in order to create the state, they really needed backing from Jews around the world and from non-Jews. So they first, when they came along with this concept of nationalism to make a state, to make a, their own, a transformation of Judaism from religion to nationalism, they really wanted to estrange themselves from God entirely. Many of them don't believe in God. It's not a religious people. The fathers of Zionism, as Theodor Herzl, Ben-Gurion, all these guys were non-religious. And they detested the religion, which if time allows us, we will get into. But basically, they wanted to make their state in Uganda, in other lands, in Patagonia, next to Argentina. So basically, their concept of what they wanted, a national home for this state, had nothing to do with Judaism. But in order to gain this backing and support, they hijacked the Jewish identity, the Star of David, the name Israel, and they started dressing themselves in this outerwear of holiness and claiming that they are the will of God. So in order to ensnare the Jewish people, they use different approaches. One of the approaches is claiming that the Jewish people who we accept as Jews, who are religious Jews, who follow the Torah, we know that the destruction of the temple that was in Jerusalem was 2,000 years ago, around 2,000 years, and we are in a godly decreed exile, forbidden to create a national home. We are to wait for the time when the Almighty will make a miracle, a metaphysical change, and all humanity will recognize God. Then we believe we will go up and serve God as a nation. We are forbidden prior to that event to go up and create a national home, to go back in mass, and different issues. Wait, just bear with a second.
Yeah.
But Zionism came along and claimed and told the Jews that they're the beginning of God's redemption. And they used different such ploys to claim that they're representing the religion, and they put on this religious facade, and they made a rabbinate and things that are also facade, and they claim that it is God's will. Mm-hmm. Now, doing so, the majority of Jews, unfortunately, around the world, as most probably many of the people know, are non-religious. They don't even keep the Ten Commandments, and they're ignorant of the religion. So they were easily conned into accepting these Zionist leaders as representing the Jewish religion and the people. There could be nothing further from the truth. And it is very important to stress that around the world, wherever you will find, invariably, the very religious communities, the more the religious, the more anti-Zionist they are. Because it's simple that these are two contradictory concepts, Zionism and Judaism. And you will, therefore, for instance, we're coming from New York, and the most religious communities in Williamsburg, the most concentrated religious Jewish community, is not one Israeli flag. And so you will find in Jerusalem and other places where they're very religious. This is something that is very important to stress. So it's not Neturei Karta that has a view. We are simply the people who are vocal in voicing the essence of Judaism that it cannot accept Zionism and the creation of this rebellion against God, the state of Israel, that says we are ignoring God's decree of exile, that we must remain in exile and create a state, And the other issue that we are forbidden to kill and steal, part of the basics of the Torah, and the state of Israel is built on theft and oppressing the people and bloodshed of all the Palestinian people and many Jews alike.
Okay, so it's not that, as you said yourself, the people who are following the religion correctly, following truly, will also oppose the state of Israel. You guys are just vocalizing that. And regardless of whether it's Palestine or Patagonia or Uganda, it's irrelevant. You don't, until the coming of the Messiah, you don't support a state of Israel.
Exactly. In other words, even if it would not be in Palestine, it would be in an uninhabited land. The rabbis would stand in total opposition because this is not what Judaism is about.
Okay.
Judaism is simply subservient. It gets compounded, the terrible crime, because it is being done in Palestine, which was an inhabited land by people who are our friends, who are our loyal saviors who helped the Jews in the times of trials and tribulations throughout history. Jews found a home in Arab and Muslim lands.
Sure. Now, what you're saying must be music to the ears of Palestinians and others who support Palestinians. What sort of response has there been from the Palestinian community to what you're saying?
With the help of the Almighty, both in the Palestinian community and in the Muslim and Arab communities at large, because thank God we travel the world, the ones who are from the older generation know this, and they say, yes, we've lived together. We've constantly lived together with Jews and Muslims prior to the United Nations or any human rights groups. We lived and we didn't need any protection to coexist, even though they were very religious Muslim communities. And the Jewish communities amongst in these Arab lands, whether it be Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, Yemen, whatever, Iran, the Jewish people flourished as very religious Jewish communities, and they were not disseminated, they were not destroyed, even though they were very rich. Why? Because this is nothing to do with a religious fight, a religious war, religious differences. That is just the ploy of Zionism to portray this as a religious conflict. So they are very happy to hear this because they are frustrated because they are being always accused as being anti-Semitic.
Sure.
And that's a ploy of Zionism.
Uh-huh. And what has been the response from the state of Israel and Jewish people living in Israel towards Natura Carta?
Well, Israel, first of all, we don't reckon with how they look at us, but obviously they look at us as their root enemy, their worst enemy, because we undermine their legitimacy. We tell the world, we uncover to the world what is happening here, what the truth is. When you say what the people of Israel, now that's a word that has to be dissected because there are different people living there. There's a very religious communities, Jewish communities, who are totally in opposition to the occupation, to the existence of the state. In fact, there was a very large Jewish community living there. There was the minority. The majority were Muslim. Then there was a Christian community and a Jewish community. The vast majority, 95% of the Jewish community, at the beginning of the 20th century, and we have all these documented, and even later till the creation of the state, there was a very strong religious Jewish community who absolutely refused to accept this creation of the state, but they were ignored. The United Nations made it because the Zionists had the power and the backing of Britain. And again, we have a book called Traditional Torah Opposition to Zionism. We have the book, The Rabbis Speak Out. This shows world opposition from the leading rabbis around the world. And here I'll just quote one line, maybe it's worthy of quoting, from the chief rabbi of Palestine in 1947, a year before the ratification of the State of Israel by the United Nations. The chief rabbi of Palestine, nothing to do with the Israeli rabbi, because we don't recognize them, that's just a facade. But the chief rabbi of Palestine, Rabbi J.Z. Dushinsky, of blessed memory, said in 1947 to a declaration before the United Nations, and I'm quoting, "We furthermore wish to express our definite opposition to a Jewish state in any part of Palestine." And this was the view shared by every religious person, not knowing of what the bloodshed that would follow with this creation of the State of Israel. They simply looked at it that this is totally forbidden to steal and to kill and to have a state. And fortunately, from that day on until today, we have the opposition, And we have, unfortunately, the endless river of bloodshed that was caused by this state.
Fantastic. Rabbi Weiss, spokesperson for Naturae Carta, thank you very much for joining us from New York. And indeed, people can get more information. I think it's nkusa.org. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And this is part of my interview with Tim Pat Coogan and his book about England's role and responsibility in the creation and the acceleration of the pain, misery and suffering of the Irish famine.
Now, Famine Atlas should have been produced back in the year 1945, which was the centenary of the famine.
Yeah.
And in that year, prior to it, in fact, De Valera approached a couple of UCD historians, well, one in particular, Dudley Edwards.
Yeah.
Robert Dudley Edwards, to produce a centenary commemorative volume.
Mm-hmm.
And he, who was a Whig historian, Butterfield was his, the Whig historian Butterfield was his kind of lodestar. He was also an expert in the Tudors.
Right.
Now, what Henry VIII and Elizabeth, is the daughter, and what they wrecked in Ireland or wreaked in Ireland would do for you by way of guidance for the Irish famine should be approached, you know, I don't know. But anyway, it wouldn't be the ideal background for it, to put it mildly. But anyway, he was also a lazy and drunken man.
Right.
And he had a sidekick, Desmond Williams. Desmond, a very nice fellow, but totally disorganised. He was both professor of history in UCD, both Peterhouse men, you know, both Cambridge, liked them all. And they fluted about with that thing.
Yeah.
For years, and they didn't really produce it at all.
Yeah.
At the end, the book appeared 13 years after the De Valera approach. It consisted of 7 large chapters. They're quite good. One of them in particular, Roger McHugh's one about what people lived on or ate during the famine, which is derived from the folklore archives in UCD. They only had to walk down the street and get this stuff, but they didn't. But it was really produced by one of the contributors, a man called Kevin B. Nolan, who's still alive and whom I interviewed. And Kevin told me about going around badgering contributors and getting chapters up on shelves and things and finally put the thing together. And to the very end, they were so lazy and so careless of their duty as editors that he actually wrote the introduction by the editors. It's signed with their initials. They didn't write it at all. He did. And he put their initials on it.
Yeah. And how could things like that happen? I mean, for the 75 or 80 years, whatever it is, off the foundation of the Republic of Ireland in the southern, in the south.
Well, they were very powerful men. And,
yeah. We've had a Republican in quote-unquote
government. Well, I mean, how could a thing like what happened to that Indian woman down in Galway happen?
Yes.
I mean, it's the slithery nature of Irish politics. They wait for the courts to solve the decision. You know, like, it was the courts introduced contraception here, not the legislators. It was just the McGee decision, as it was called in the High Court, validated by the Supreme Court, which allowed the importation of contraceptions for this woman, McGee.
Mm.
I think she might have had to go to Europe as well. But anyway, that kind of thing. And they faced up to the X case, and then they backed away from actually implementing, hoping it would go away.
Yeah.
And I mean, apart from the agony the woman died in and the trauma they've occasioned her husband and the damage they've done to the Indian community, they seem to have no idea of the effect on the world's media. That's our politicians' view.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they were even more hidebound and churchbound. One of the things that happened during the famine, and mind you, this is a distinct relevance to today, is that the habit born out of the two forms of colonialism, Mother England and Mother Church, and the cap-touching and the deference, we have a very strong tendency to learned helplessness.
Mm.
She can do nothing about it.
Yeah.
And if I said to you, and don't crown his authority, and we had censorship as well, official censorship, that means censorship of the mind, that you can't, you know, you don't think for yourself.
Yeah.
And this certainly, this is one of the quarrels that the Protestants had, and the Protestant-controlled educational system at the time of the famine tried to teach Bible reading so that people could read the thing for themselves and develop habits of independent thought, whereas the bishops were against that.
Mm.
Then the Protestants discredited themselves by the effort of some of the supers to get people to change their minds.
Yeah.
Their religion, rather.
That's right. They would get assistance from
they'd
the
They'd get food, and they get houses sometimes.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a damnable thing to do. But, of course, yeah. Catholic missionaries and evangelicals, you never hear the word evangelical or proselytizing used about the missions.
Mm.
It's missionaries.
Yes.
What are they trying to do?
Yeah.
Change the religion to people. But mind you, I've been through Africa, and you would not hear a bad word about the Irish missionaries. Don't mind what anyone tells you. The African educational system today is laid down by Irish missionaries, and often laid down at the cost of their lives,
mm.
not the conditions they lived in. And they left a good deposit there. And part of the NGO tradition we still have, we always had that missionary tradition going out through Europe, the old medieval monks.
Yeah.
But the famine heightened that. But unfortunately, that learned helplessness thing, which is still with us, meant they didn't rise up. They didn't have habits of independent thought to answer your question about the famine.
Mm.
The level of education was such, I mean, there would have been 3,000 or 4,000 people going to college then, 8,000 in the whole country. I remember when I left school in 1954, there was a paragraph in the Independent on page one saying that we had 3,000 boys and girls sitting down today to do the Leaving Cert. Well, I would imagine today there'd be, what, 40,000 doing
something
it, you know,
like that, yeah.
And going on, most of them for yeah. a third level. So a different climate. But the learned helplessness is still there. And, for example, if I were to say to you, possibly not you, but to most people,
mm.
it's a disgrace. Look at the suicides. Look at people's savings wiped out. Look at pensioners who were told to put their money into bank shares. Look at the way they're living now. Look at people in terror losing their jobs. Look at emigration starting again. Look at unemployment and nobody going to jail. And the immediate answer you get is no, and they won't either.
Mm.
Because in Ireland, they don't expect you can, that they do that, or they won't.
Mm.
They announced several years after the crash, they announced this week only, you can check it in the news, that white-collar crime has gone up, and that the reason is that the fraud squad have no backup. They need solicitors, they need barristers, they need forensic accountants,
mm-hmm.
and they can't be appointed
mm-hmm.
because of the public service embargo.
Okay.
So the catch-22, the people who caused this terrible crash and created the public service embargo are going scot-free
yeah.
because of the public service embargo. And the bloody government, which is allowing people to go away with £500,000 pensions, allowing huge amount of money to be paid for discredited bankers to work in banks, allowing civil servants to go scot-free in the Department of Finance, who should have been watching what was happening, allowing the central bankers to go free,
yeah.
allowing all the directors of the banks and many other companies, allowing things to go like those bed and breakfast loans.
Yeah. And do you see...
And all those people are just... Don't disturb the cosy club of the dawn.
Right, okay.
But all they have to do is put in a handful of solicitors and barristers and accountants into them. The chief apparatus of the state,
yeah.
you know, cab and all that, not merely criminal assets you want, it's to go backwards and
yeah.
see what happened. And the police are excellent. Don't anyone tell you they're not. They could get the evidence, but they can't carry the war
yeah.
in the courts.
And do you see this as somewhat connected to what that's learned helplessness?
Yeah, I do, yes.
Yeah,
people should challenge that.
Yes.
They should demand it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm very glad that as we're speaking, the trade unions have at last brought people out in the streets today.
Okay.
I don't know how it'll go, but I mean, it's monstrous that the decent people of Ireland are suffering all these agonies, and it is agony. I don't accept the word austerity. It's hardship is the word we should use.
Mm.
I mean, there's hunger back in Ireland. We've lost our government. Mm. We've lost our sovereignty. The government is still there, but we're in the begging bowl position, standing in a dole queue in Brussels with the IMF and the Cent,
yeah.
what you call them, all these institutions,
the
Troika.
Yeah.
And people say, Asha, what can you do?
What can you do?
And this is taking place on the eve of one of the worst budgets in the history of Ireland.
Yeah.
We're promised more taxes,
it's
property tax. People who are already scourged
yeah.
to take more wounds. The good, the decent. And the people who caused all this are still walking around free without letter hindrance and no sanction. That's where letter hindrance, that's the legacy of the famine.
Again, which is the legacy?
That circumstance is a legacy of the famine.
Now this
the evil walking around free and the good paying for them.
Yeah, okay. Now there was a belief, based on what you're saying, a belief, probably even more than a belief, that among the British establishment that this famine was good for us in some certain way. It was God's lesson or something like that. Is there,
that was providentialism. Yeah. That was widespread.
Is there any evidence that they applied the same belief to their own people back in England?
Well, I mean, the difference between the clearances in the Highlands and Ireland, I mean, sure, they cleared them, they shipped them out, but yeah. They went in well-founded ships, and at least they were fed and they were dressed properly and able to withstand the cold. I mean, I stood in a dock on the Clyde up from Dumbarton one day with an Irish, his father and mother were from Mayo, but he's a very well-respected journalist in the area, and he showed me there, and that side, without my hand there, I would touch the dock, touch the ground if I wished, where the sailing ships left for Nova Scotia, New Scotland, those places to take the Highlanders who had been cleared, who were not mostly Catholics too. And where I was standing, and down to my left, was where the Irish emigrants came aboard from the packet from, came ashore, I mean, from the packet from Belfast, and landed and died there from typhus, two weeks to go on.
And was this treatment ultimately meted out to the Irish because we were resistant to British rule?
Yes, and they had this belief that some of them, now, not all of them, because after all, a lot of them, Peel didn't do that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can't say that all the Conservatives were kindly, because Disraeli, for example, who succeeded and was anything but.
Yeah.
And I've quoted what he had to say about the Irish, and it's appalling. But by and large, until the churches got at it, and until the Whigs, Trevelyan and Palmerston particularly, particularly Woods and Trevelyan, got the PR machine going, the Irish, they were sympathetic to them.
Mm.
But then you get Woods making statements like, never was a nation so generous to an ungrateful nation, you know, that was one that has gone around the world trumpeting their rebelliousness and their ingratitude and looking for more money, like trying to keep children alive. This was our ingratitude. And above all, what they had on their side was the Times.
Uh-huh.
They got control of the Times, really. The famous editor, Delam, at the time, uttered a proverb, if you like, a saying anyway, that is the rule of newspapers ever after. Mm-hmm. The press lives by disclosures. So the powers that be saw that he got plenty of disclosures, plenty of news about everything. And in return, now you'd have to class yourself back into those days when the Times was, this would be the equivalent of Sky, BBC, Channel 4, Telegraph.
And probably even more powerful, because that's all was.
That's right. It was. And it was taken abroad as the voice of England. So it was absolutely the way it was. It was sacred writ. And they published editorials like, we welcome the famine. When the Irishman learns to get rid of... Yeah, I mean, I've quoted them. When the Irishman learns to... ceases to be potato fadging, in other words, potato eating, and adopts meat. Eating meat's going to bring habits.
So they were doing it for our own good.
You were going to become more moral if you ate meat. It was going to make you more reliable and more industrious. You wouldn't be lazy. You'd see the virtues of hard work.
Most of this has either been airbrushed or totally ignored in Irish history.
Yeah, and you still got that fellow with the Times that your man rang me up to talk about, saying they was historically doubtful.
Yes.
Without having read the book.
Yes, of course, absolutely.
But the editorial I like, that I hesitate to use the word like, but the one I would commend to you is symbolising the attitude of the Times. And it was probably written there, because they actually wrote some of these editorials, Trevelyan and Woods. Could have been written by Trevelyan, I can't really swear to that. But in view of these letter phraseology is very similar. He says, the London Times said this, the Times, and this is an exact quote, I've memorised it. We look forward to the day when a Celt on the banks of the Shannon will be as rare as the red man on the banks of the Hudson. They, he, you know, famine raved. They pointed to the the outburst of generosity from the ordinary public at the start, and from, I mean, some of the English worked really diligently in famine relief committees and gave, big people like Rothschild and these fellows worked and gave their offices over to it.
Right.
But actually Trevelyan didn't like that. He only gave £25 to that outburst initially, and Woods gave 250. And by the time the famine was finished, they had that relief effort paired way back.
Yeah, so were Palmerston and Trevelyan and guys like this, they were on a mission themselves.
And again, I've given, it's not my opinion now.
Yes.
This is not historically doubtful. I have quoted Woods and Trevelyan saying things like, to people who would object, like, I think it was Monteagle who wrote to Trevelyan, he knew where the power lay, pointing out the evils about to befall the peasantry in one particularly bad weather, bad winter, could have been 47 or 48. Mm. Remember, this bloody thing went on from 45 to, the deaths really set in. Nobody died under Peel from starvation, but from 46 to 51, by God, they did. Mm-hmm. And to show you the duplicity of the lies, in 48, Trevelyan published a book, The Irish Crisis, showing his great efforts and what he had done, and claiming the famine was over.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible deaths still to occur in awful conditions. But anyway, just to finish out, to give an example of what they were glossing over and what they were saying, when people, we'll say it was Monteagle, or it could have been anybody, complained, there's a letter there in which he says, you can't, look, it's not bad, really. I mean, things are going well enough. We're getting rid of the middlemen. The middlemen were the people who took the big chunks of land from the landlords and rented it out at ever-increasing rents in small lots to these peasants who were living on them and growing the potatoes.
Yeah.
So to get rid of them. But your man wasn't writing about middlemen or economics. He was writing about the need to save the starving.
Yeah.
And
this
is what your man thought was the silver lining in the cloud.
Yeah.
And he talked about that silver lining, and a divine providence is doing this and a divine providence is doing that. And he had a phrase which both he and Woods used, or that Wood used. Woods seemed to use everything he said.
Yeah.
He said, the situation will only be remedied by natural causes or natural events. I forget which he used, natural events, natural causes. Anyway, natural events are, if you evict a woman in her 60s, barefooted, with no rain gear, the granny, say, and her children, and her, you know, her daughter and her husband, also no rain gear and barefooted, and their children, in the middle of a January sleet storm, natural events will take care of the problem fairly quickly. And you use that kind of emollient language. He, Woods refused in very bitter editorial he got, and very in the Times, to justify, we talk about the ingratitude of the Irish, to justify his refusing a particular loan of 50,000 or 100,000, 250, I think it was 50, for children alone.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even do that. Mm-hmm. Trevelyan stopped another thing during the winter, surplus army clothing.
Yeah,
it's gone old or was surplus requirement. He wouldn't allow that to be distributed in Ireland to the people to cover the nakedness.
So effectively, even today, would you say we have let the British off the hook in relation to the responsibility over the famine?
We have, yes. And
we had Tony Blair's comment.
Tony Blair now deserves more credit over Ireland than any other English Prime Minister. I know from my knowledge, as they say, of my knowledge, you know, I've written this book about the IRA, which is regarded as the standard work, and I have my context, and I can tell you that Tony Blair is still highly regarded by the former IRA leadership, that he was the man who made peace possible, and it began with his apology for the famine. He did understand the debt owed to the Irish for what happened then. The Donegal childhood, the granny up there, Protestant lady, whom he spent the holidays with, he imbibed more than the Guinness he began to drink up there. He got the fireside tales about the famine, and he was right, and it struck a nerve, and you can trace the beginning of the peace process from that speech. I mean, there were back channels, there was all sorts, but that was evidence of good faith and evidence of a new mindset, and it worked. And an irony, by the way, you may remember, or you may know, that the IRA blew up Lord Mountbatten.
Yes.
After, that was a terrible deed, and that was a shocking thing. The child was blown up, an old lady, and local boy who was working on the boat. But anyway, they did it. And then they issued a statement after it, giving their reasons, one of which was the famine. Now, ironically, the castle that that party had set out from that morning, Mountbatten and the rest, that holiday party, that castle was once Palmerston's. That was his estate.
Uh-huh.
It just shows you the way the way some people think historically, and how people who would do that, knowing, of course, that the castle was Palmerston's once, they would be affected by Blair's speech, you know.
And where, if you can answer this, I'm not really sure if it can be answered, where do we go from here in terms of Irish people dealing with the famine and holding the British and other people responsible for the famine?
Well, I think that what we should do is behave with dignity and without rancour, to see that the lessons are learned, that we have justice in this country to begin with, for everybody, and that we just don't go on blandly using smokescreen or PR to avoid putting the people responsible in the dock. There should be people in jail, just as Enron executives in America went to jail for what they did. We should have enough strength of character to do that, and regard the entitlements of the poorest of the poor who are out of jobs now as important as the former chairman of a bank. And it should be subject to the same law. The little man in the dole hasn't done anything wrong, the other fellow has. That's one thing. The second thing, we should continue our efforts for the third world. We should be very, that should be, we should be careful about aid. I mean, John O'Shea had many faults, but one thing he hadn't was, he wasn't stupid, and he did a lot setting up that goal organisation, should be remembered to him, which again is based on the missionary tradition and the famine. And he said all along, he was saying it publicly, we shouldn't be giving aid to Uganda, that they were corrupt and they were had enough money apparently to wage wars in neighbouring countries to get at the diamonds, so why were we giving them money? And now it proves that millions went down the tubes there. We should stop that, because apart from that being wrong in itself when we can't afford it, it also makes people leery about continuing foreign aid. Well, we should continue.
So you're saying the putting people to jail over recent financial scandals, continuing aid, is there anything else we should do as well?
Try to be as humane and as decent a country as possible. Treasure our sovereignty. Treasure our sovereignty. I cannot say that enough, loud enough. What I'm talking about would probably have happened to a degree, given the detritus of conquest, given the overpopulation of the land. But instead of a humane system of emigration being devised, and instead of industry being developed, part of the famine was caused by the fact there was no roads. You couldn't distribute food in a place like Mayo. There was only one workhouse for Connemara, like Clifton. It went bankrupt. It was 200,000 acres. There was one estate there. Humanity Dick Martin, the man, the jewellist who founded the Society of Invention of Cruelty to Animals, went bankrupt, had to be sold. And one of the most devastating comments about the famine is, there's a note in the prospectus of the auctioneers assuring would-be buyers that it actually, the estate is modern Connemara. That's what it was. It was that big, 200,000 acres. And they're assuring prospective buyers that the people named in the 1841 census as living on the estate were no longer there. Now that means ethnically cleansing. It was ethnically cleansing. 200,000 acres, given the subdivision of land, given the size of families, represents at least 200,000 people, if not more. Gone. Like chaff.
And for those crimes of ethnic cleansing,
I may say flatly in the book,
how do we hold the British responsible for
that? I'll tell you one of the things that's happening, and I'm supporting it, but I just want to go back to the question of sovereignty. That happened because we had no government. We were appealing for the crumbs for the rich, from the rich man's table in Whitehall. And unfortunately, the man sitting at the head of the table was Charles Trevelyan. And the man sitting at the other end of the table was Charles Wood. And now it's a different table in a different city. It's in Brussels. And sitting at are the European Central Bank, the IMF, and the other member of the Troika, another bank.
Yes.
And we're completely at their mercy, and they're dictating these cuts. We need the money. We have to take it. We're very glad to get it. It was our own fault in many ways. Laxity. We had a drunken prime minister and a dying finance minister. What Bertie Ahern was doing as finance minister in his time when all this was building up, and then as Taoiseach, I don't know, but I'd like to hear it at a tribunal or something. I'd like to hear him give an account to the Dáil of what he thought he was doing. I mean, what I remember him saying was that he'd wonder about people who were criticising the Celtic Tiger and worrying that a bubble would burst. He was said, his famous comment was, you'd wonder about people who are that miserable that they wouldn't go and commit suicide.
Yeah.
But by God, a lot of people are committing suicide now. I can tell you that in Glasnevin and in the local undertakers, they've told me that suicide rates in this country are up by 50%. So I'd hold the Irish to account before I'd start holding the British to account. But I think it's important for them to understand our susceptibilities and why there is mistrust of England. I mean, the crown is, and yet it shows you there's still an affection for England, because the crown is the symbol of oppression, yet look at how popular the Queen is and the royal family are. And absent the North, there's no reason for us not to be friendly. You can see how friendly they are to us, to our soccer players, to our athletes. The British are very popular on BBC, Irish, I mean, on BBC, etc. We've always had our friends over there. But I think for rational discourse, there's an exercise which I would commend to you as being the template of what our attitude should be. Being conducted, needless to say, not in Dublin, not in UCD, but in an American university in Fordham, New York, next April, when there's a tribunal being set up with academics on both sides of the argument, prosecuting England and defending England. And these are objective historians versed in the famine. I think that's the way to go about it. And I'm delighted, I've been honoured to be made a patron of that, along with well-known fellow terrorists like Brian Friel and Robert Balla, our leading artist.
Very good.
Now, those are the sort of exercises that I like to see forward. Learn from the past so that we won't replicate it. Don't be, not breeding hatred, breed understanding. And say, never again can such a thing be allowed to happen, and eliminate evil side effects or evil effects like learned helplessness. We have lost our sovereignty, but we still have a country, and we should be proud of it.
Very good. Timpak Coogan, author of The Famine Plot, England's Role in Ireland's Greatest Tragedy. Thank you very much.
You're very well.